Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Just thinking about why questions are good, we want to think about responding to questions both publicly but also conversationally. This is much more thinking about it conversationally. We picked up on some of these things already, but I just thought it might be helpful just to give you a list. So questions help us. How do we know where people are coming from with their questions? Often we'll need to ask them more to find out what is the background so we know how to answer the question appropriately. Questions come for different reasons, as we'll see again in a minute. But we've also said that questions don't just help us, but they help the people we're speaking to. Jesus didn't ask questions because he needed to know the answer. He asked questions because he wanted people to think for themselves, and we've seen that in Andrew's example. How do they help other people? Here's some examples. It helps them think through their assumptions. It unlocks their assumptions. Think of the rich young ruler story, another example where Jesus doesn't answer the question when he's asked that very clear question, you know, what must I do to inherit eternal life? But ask the question, why do you call me good? Why? Because this guy's assumption is that good people go to heaven. What do I need to do to be good enough? Jesus asks the question that opens up that assumption. And as we think about people coming with their questions, everyone comes with assumptions about God, about the Bible, about Christianity. Many of them are wrong. And so a question can get them to articulate what their assumptions are so that we can start on that level first. It exposes false logic. Sometimes you get asked questions and you think, whatever I say in answer to this question, the answer is wrong, or the answer is going to make me look stupid. The problem there is not often with you, but with the question. There's a form of false logic where you're forced to admit to something you don't want to admit to, a false dichotomy. It's what happened on the school playground when I was a kid. People used to say, does your mother know you're stupid? Yes or no? And you would think, well, if I say yes, I'm admitting to being stupid. If I say no, I'm still admitting to being stupid, just that my mother doesn't know about it. You can do the same thing to married men, by the way. You just say, yes or no, have you stopped beating your wife? And if they say yes, I have stopped beating my wife, then admitting to their what's doing so. And if they say so no, then it would seem that they still do. So the question can be phrased in such a way that whatever you say, you're admitting to something you don't want to admit to. It's a trick question, like we saw earlier. And a question, when the question to you is a trick question in response is very helpful. It ensures conversations. You know, if you're in a conversation, you can't give a 20-minute talk in response to the question. If you do, you probably will never get asked another question. So how do we make sure that we deal comprehensively with the issue without just talking at people? And that's by asking questions so that we have a conversation about the topic rather than you just trying to give everything you know on that particular issue. Asking questions defines the issue. We said yesterday, you know, people use words like God, suffering, science. What do we mean by those words? You know, when someone says to me, I don't believe in God, it's not original to me. Lots of people have used this idea, but just, well, what do you mean by God? And normally, so many negative adjectives get used at this point. It's very simple, simply to say, I don't believe in that kind of God either. If you seek to defend the existence of a God in their mind who is vindictive and capricious and everything else, they've got vested interests in not wanting that God to exist. So ask them what they mean by it first. It will really help you. Similarly, words like faith. You know, I wish I had your faith, said my hairdresser to me once. And I thought, well, that's a nice compliment. And so I asked her what she meant by the word faith, and she said to me, faith is believing things that aren't true. And then I realized it wasn't a compliment at all. It was an insult. And so asking her what she meant by it was really important. Don't assume people use have the same meanings. It deals with apathy. We mentioned yesterday, often the problem is not that certain people are antagonistic, but they're apathetic. How do we deal with apathy? And again, asking questions can push back on people's apathy. One example of this, just to give you very quickly, I was in Denmark doing a mission, and there's a real, not just in Denmark, but we found a real apathy among many of the students in this university we were working in. And one of the girls just said after the talk, oh, I'm not particularly bothered about this, which is a bit discouraging when you've just given your heart and you've preached on the resurrection for 20 minutes. And so I said to her, what are you bothered about? Because although not everyone is bothered about God, or at least they don't think they are, everybody's bothered about something. And she said, well, I care about love. So I said to her, well, how would you define love? And she thought for a moment, and she said, well, I don't know. And I thought, well, you know, I pushed back. I said, well, look, you said you care about love. I thought you might know what it was. She says, well, I'm not sure. So I said, can I give you a definition of love? She said, sure. Now, I didn't give her a Christian definition because she wouldn't have been ready to listen. So I said to her, love is a chemical reaction that's evolved in our brains to make us attracted to people, normally of the opposite sex, so that we have sexual relationships with them and so we can pass on our DNA. And she looked at me, perhaps because her boyfriend was sitting next to her, and said, that isn't love. And I simply said to her, why not? She said, I don't know. And I said, if there is no God and all there is matter, why should we think that love is anything more than just a chemical reaction? And how could we say it's anything more? And then she said, I've never thought about that before. What do you think love is? And now she was ready to talk about a Christian worldview on love because she'd seen briefly the inadequacy of her worldview. Okay, so when people are apathetic, they don't care about God, fine. But they do care about something. Let's start with what they do care about and take it by using questions. They deal with apathy, and then lastly, they get to the hearts. Sometimes in conversations about questions, you feel you're not really getting to the real issues. And two questions, diagnostic questions, that I find are really helpful are, firstly, if I could answer all of your questions satisfactorily, would you put your trust in Jesus Christ? It's not the first question I would ask, but after a while, maybe 20 minutes or half an hour of a conversation, if I could answer all these questions, would you? If they say yes, fine, what's your next question? But often it's no. And then the next question would be, okay, these aren't the real issue. What is the thing that really stops you from considering doing that for yourself? And often it's not an intellectual issue, but it's a moral issue that's the barrier. But they would never articulate it unless you ask them the question. And you've earned the right to by answering a number of their other questions first. A similar question on that, I tried this up in Warsaw. I was talking to a student who was very kind of antagonistic, all sorts of issues about the Bible, about the evidence of the Bible. And I said, look, if I could show you convincingly that Jesus was the Son of God, that he did rise from the dead, and that the Bible is true, would you become a Christian? And he said, you can't. I said, sorry, that wasn't my question. I didn't ask whether you think I could. I asked, if I could, would you? He said, you can't. I said, no, you still haven't answered the question. And he said, but you can't. And I said, you've just shown why this conversation is a waste of time. He said, no, it's not. I said, yes, it is. He said, why is it? I said, because you've shown that you've already got an assumption that God doesn't exist, that miracles are impossible, and therefore, because of your assumption, you're not even prepared to consider the Bible as evidence. This conversation is a waste of time. Unless you're open to the fact that there might be a God and that miracles might be possible, then the evidence is never going to persuade you, because you'll already write it off on the basis of your assumption, okay? So the question got to the kind of heart. Another kind of question, not from someone who's antagonistic, but for someone who's more open, would simply be, you know, I'm happy to keep talking about these things, but can you just tell me what's stopping you from becoming a Christian? Or if that terminology of becoming a Christian is misunderstood in your culture, particularly in Orthodox cultures, that just means, well, I am one already. Just to say, from putting your trust in Jesus, or from seriously following Jesus Christ with your life. And again, that will get to the heart to find out what the issues are. And you may find that these issues, they're not insurmountable barriers, but actually they're closer than you think, okay? So those are things to bear in mind when it comes to answering questions. One other thing, just to say, a couple of case studies or case examples of where we do this, just to let you know, we're doing this in Britain, but it's not just in the UK that we're doing this with students, all over Europe. We're doing these kind of, we can use the word apologetic. Like Lindsay was saying earlier, we just prefer to use the term persuasive evangelism, sharing the gospel in a way that deals with questions and shows the intellectual coherence of the Christian faith. So two examples. Firstly, in Malta. Malta's, you know where it is, but it's a very strongly Catholic country, very small student movements in Malta. But over the last few years, we've done a number of mission weeks in the university there. How did they do it? They started in the Freshers' Week, the first week of term, by doing a survey of the students on campus, asking, what is your one question that you would want to ask God if you could? And they got, I think it was 500 responses to different questions that people had during that week. They even got the president and the prime minister of Malta to give their responses. They had a stall in the university where they put all these up. They had an active team of people come to help with that. And then from those, they collated the top five questions that they roughly fell into as categories. And then we had five lunchtime talks where we addressed the answers to those five big questions. And we had probably 20 or 30 people a day coming along to that, most of them not believers. And by the end of the week, about 30 contacts for the Christian student group to follow up. And the Christian student group at that time was two, okay? So just think, this is not something that has to be done by a group of 100 or 500. Two Christian students, supported by a small team from outside, organised that. And then just a few weeks ago in Novi Sad in Serbia, in the university in Novi Sad, during the day, a stall, a question board, engaging people, handing out drinks, conversations. And then in the main student canteen, or one of the student cafes on campus, they booked out in the evening, starting with a public debate on the first night with a well-known member of the Atheist Society in Serbia, and then three consecutive talks the following evenings on three of the big questions that had come up. And again, probably about 100 people a night coming along, and probably about over 50% of those non-Christians. 6 years ago, when I went to Novi Sad, I was told we could never do public evangelism in Novi Sad, we can't get venues, and no one would come. 6 years later, they had events that were probably better than some of the events I've spoken at this year in England in terms of the engagement of non-Christians coming. So just to give you the idea, in the student context, this can work not just in the British context, okay? We'll think about churches tomorrow. Now, today's topic we want to think through is how can there be only one way to God? So again, just want to do those two things as we start. Why does this come up as an issue? Why would people raise this as a question? And secondly, what questions could we ask, thinking about what we've just thought? Just to save time, rather than discussing the first one, let's just shout them out. Why do you think this comes up as an issue? Why do people raise this as a question? Okay, so that could be, they could be a Muslim, they could be whatever, and they think, well, you know, you're a Christian, I'm a Muslim, can there just be one way? And don't assume, by the way, that they're not from a different religion just because they don't look that way. Obviously, there can be people who might be in a religious commitment that you just don't know about. Yeah. Okay, so people, the assumption that there's elements of truth in all of them. Actually, we want to be careful there, wouldn't we? Because actually, in claiming that Jesus is the only way to God, we're not saying that everything about every religion is wrong, are we? We would actually agree with some of the moral teachings of some religions. We don't think they're salvific. They don't have the ability to get us to God. But we need to be careful that we aren't heard as saying everything you do is wrong and evil. There can be good things, but did they go far enough? Okay? But yeah. So? Okay, syncretism. So the belief that all religions are basically, they're compatible. We can fit them together. Common basis to it. And there's a strong philosophical opinion, and it's very popular, isn't it, in the West. Intolerance, yeah. I think this is the big issue. People are not asking this in terms of, like, you know, tell me how it works very often. They're saying, how can you claim that Jesus is the only way? Isn't that so intolerant? Rules, ways to get to God, right? Ways of being good. A bit like the rich young ruler. And so if you say, my religion gets me to God, but yours doesn't, or I, as a Christian, am going to heaven, but you, because you're not, aren't, if that's what you're inferring, and people's assumption is religion is about what you do to be good so you can go to heaven, what they hear you saying is, I'm better than you. I'm morally superior. That's why I'm going to heaven and you're not, you see? That's why the assumption is really important to crack open, because if you don't deal with the assumption, then, you know, what an arrogant person. Now, of course, that's not what we're saying at all, and we need to explain that. But that's what people might hear if we simply made a statement without explaining it. Yeah, okay. Why do you think this is an issue so much in Europe, and in particularly now? Europe is so multicultural. I'm not saying other parts of the world aren't, but particularly Europe is so multicultural. This question is taken in a different way, isn't it? When what about other religions doesn't mean people who live in a different country who I haven't met, but it's the people who I work with, the people who live next door. It becomes much more personal then, doesn't it? So because of the multicultural societies that we live in, this is a particularly big question, I think. Okay, what do you mean by God? How can there be only one way to God? If they've used religion in the word, the question you could also ask them, what do you mean by religion? Defining the issues. Great question to ask. It's interesting, obviously, because if they say, well, God, there is one God, well, you could, your next question, what about Buddhism? Or what about Hinduism? So that could be a follow-on question. But yeah, question to define the issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a question to open up assumptions. So what would you need to do to be saved? How do you think you do get to God? Or what do you think religion is about? Those kind of questions that will get people to articulate where they're coming from. You may have an idea, but it's really helpful for them to actually say that, because then you can start to probe. And rather than saying, I disagree with you, it would actually be better to then to ask some follow-up questions, wouldn't it? How does that work? Yeah, it's about being good. How do you know when you've been good enough? Where do you draw the line between those who are good enough and those who are not, and so on? Get people to start to see the inconsistency or the difficulties with their own belief system before you give an alternative one. If they don't see the problems of their own, they won't be open to the alternative. But yeah, so unlocking assumptions. Okay, that's a really good question. Where do you think we could get the answer from? Because that's actually finding out where people's authority lies, doesn't it? Am I the ultimate authority? Is there a source of authority? Is there the possibility that we could find an answer? So often people come out with assumptions, don't they? You know, where do we get that assumption from? Well, that's just what I believe. Can't believe the Bible, but I can just make up my own assumptions. So asking, and then do you think, I mean, that could be a leading question that can take us down the direction. I think rather than going straight to the, well, it is the Bible, but to go to Jesus and say, could there be someone who could speak with enough authority to give us an answer to that question? Often with postmoderns, it's quite interesting because the reason why we think it's arrogant to claim there's only one way to God is, well, who are you to say that? You're limited to your culture, to your generation in history, and so on. How can you have absolute truth? And we can say, I don't. I am limited by my perspective, but I have found one that has got a different perspective, a unique perspective on life, because he has absolute truth, because he is the truth. So it's pointing away from ourselves to him. And I think Jules picks up something really, just to repeat it. So Jules is just saying, often we can feel, if we're in that conversation, we don't know how to respond to it straight away. It would take practice to actually think about how we can respond to it well. I think absolutely, often when you watch people having conversations and they seem so spontaneous, it's often planned spontaneity. They've thought about how to deal with that issue, and that's why it seems to sound so natural. And I would say, one of the things we can do is we can train ourselves better to answer questions. You know, if this did come up, how would you do it in a conversation? How would you take that? What questions could you ask? You know, good questions aren't always easy to come by, are they? They take a bit of thought. I remember 6 years ago here at the ELF, well, it wasn't here, it was in Hungary, but at the ELF, thinking about this idea of questions, and a friend of mine who was here with me, we were sharing a room, and so we came up with this challenge in the swimming pool. And we said, okay, we're going to have a conversation. You're going to be the non-Christian, I'm going to be the Christian, then we're going to swap rounds. And you're going to ask me a question, and I can only respond by asking questions. Okay, I can't give statements, I can only ask questions. But because it takes a little while to think of the question, we actually swam a length in between each question. So we had a length to think about our next question. And it was great fun doing it, but it just made us think, oh, that question was helpful because it took us in this direction. That question was really unhelpful because it took us down a dead end. And learning how to do this, even practicing together, so that when you're in the real situation, you can think, okay, I've got a good question I could ask in this situation, okay? And if you have a conversation and you think you make a mess of it, and by the way, we all do, I come away from conversations thinking, oh, wish I'd, you know, I didn't make a very good job of that. Then you, rather than just despairing, number one, pray, because the Lord can use our inadequate efforts more than we know. And then secondly, if I had that conversation again, what would I do differently? Maybe go and talk to someone else and explain what happens, and they might have an idea. Okay, that might help us. Okay, we're going to go into the talk part of it. That's really helpful to have those to start with, as we have those in mind. So again, put yourself in the situation. You're in Malta, wearing your shorts and t-shirt, and the sun is shining, and it's lunch bar time. And we're looking today at this subject, how can there be only one way to God? Isn't it incredibly arrogant to claim that you've got the truth and that you're going to God and other people aren't? This has always been a question, but perhaps particularly a question in the multicultural societies in which we live in Europe today. I grew up in a city in England called Leicester, and Leicester had the privilege of being the first city in England to have an ethnic majority, more people from a non-English background than from England itself, which meant, of course, there were many, many different religious beliefs represented in my own town. You could find mosques and temples and synagogues and churches on almost every street corner. And of course, it raised the question for me, how can I claim as a Christian that I'm right and all these other people are wrong? Surely that's a really arrogant thing to claim. I was speaking at a university in the south of England, and a girl came up to me after the talk and she said, "Look, I accept everyone no matter what they believe. Why can't you? And why can't God?" And so it's really popular, isn't it, to say, it doesn't matter what you believe. All beliefs basically are compatible. And all beliefs will get you to God at the end of the day, or at least they'll get you to where you want to get to. Don't claim that one is right and that others are wrong. Now, that's really popular today, particularly in our part of the world. But actually, I just want to ask four questions about that idea. And firstly, what is the evidence for that belief? I use the word belief quite deliberately there, because when we say that all religions are the same, that is in itself a belief. But actually, are there reasons for thinking that belief is true? I'm always told that I should believe things not because they're simply nice, but because they're true. But what is the evidence for that belief? Certainly not everyone in the world holds to it. The Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga was once in a debate with a religious pluralist, someone who thinks that all religions are basically going in the same direction. And this pluralist said to Alvin Plantinga, "If you were born in Morocco, you wouldn't be a Christian." And Alvin Plantinga said to this man, "If you were born in Morocco, you wouldn't be a religious pluralist." There are many people in the world that don't hold this belief. What makes you think that you're right and they're wrong? Secondly, this ignores the very real differences between religions. You don't need to be an expert in world religions to know there are some fairly fundamental differences between them on the question of God's existence and character, for a start. Someone once said, it's not that the religions of the world are fundamentally similar and only superficially different, but actually they're fundamentally different and only superficially similar. How do we reconcile that? Well, my religious studies teacher at school always used this illustration, as many people have, to explain how you can do that. There's an elephant and there's blind men, and they're feeling the elephant and they're trying to work out what it is. One person feels its side and thinks it's a brick wall. One person feels its tail and thinks it's a rope. Another person feels its leg and thinks it's a tree. And we'll stop with the body parts there. And they're all coming to different conclusions about what the elephant is. Now, the person giving the illustration says, well, that's like religion. They're all grasping at ultimate reality and coming to different conclusions. But they're all grasping the same thing. But actually, what's the problem with that illustration? There's at least a couple, I would suggest. Firstly, it's quite an arrogant illustration, isn't it? Because who is it that claims to be able to see what the elephant is? And it's the person giving the illustration. In other words, they're saying, I have seen and glimpsed what ultimate reality is, and all the religions of the world are blind in comparison. Which is very arrogant. Also, there's another mistake or problem with the illustration, and that is, they weren't all right, were they? They were all wrong. They'd all got completely the wrong end of the stick, or the elephant, you might say. You see, it wasn't a tree or a wall, it was an elephant. They hadn't got anywhere close to what the truth actually was. Here's the third issue with this idea of pluralism, and that is that tolerance assumes that you disagree with someone. You see, I'm told very regularly in the culture that I come from, the United Kingdom, that we live in a tolerant society. There's nothing wrong with that. Actually, I would say that's one of the fruits of a Christian worldview in our society through history. But tolerance doesn't assume you have to agree with everyone. It assumes you actually disagree with them. For if you agree with people, you don't need to tolerate them. You simply agree with them. It's when you disagree with someone that you have to tolerate them. And so tolerance is good, but it shouldn't be redefined to mean agreeing with everything that everyone says. It's not what it means. And then fourthly, I'd say this, you can't get away from exclusivity no matter how hard you try. See, someone put it this way, there are really four views when it comes to religion. You can say that they're all right, even the crazy ones with the flying spaghetti monster. You can say, okay, no, some of them are right, we'll exclude a few of them. or one of them is right. Or, of course, you could say that none of them are right. We live in a materialistic world and none of them are right at all. Now, often people say, how arrogant is view number three, the view that says that only one religion is right. But actually, all of those views are exclusive. If you say that all religions are right, you have to disagree with the people who say that some of them are right or one of them are right and or none of them are right. If you say that some of them are right, you're disagreeing with the people who say that all of them are right and one of, and so on. Whatever you think about religion, you'll end up disagreeing with someone, somewhere. That's just the nature of truth. So rather than trying to maybe do the perhaps more lazy thing of saying, well, they're all basically the same, we should ask the question, where should we start when it comes to our investigation into religion? If religions aren't all the same, what should we do? I guess there are different options. One option is to say, well, it doesn't matter. I'll just give up. It doesn't matter what you believe. End of Eurovision the other week, the winner said, we're all heroes. It doesn't matter what you believe. Now, that's great, isn't it? Until you actually start to think about it. Doesn't matter what you believe. What if what you believe involves chopping people's heads off? Of course what we believe matters. These beliefs might have implications. And so we should say that beliefs are important, at least to think about. Of course, you could say, well, I'll study all the religions in the world, decide which one is best, and then I'll make my choice. I've got nothing against you doing that. If Christianity is worth following, it's worth following because you've looked at the alternatives and it stands out in comparison, not simply because you're naive to the alternatives. But there's a practical problem, and that is it's going to take you a long time to do that. When will you know enough to ever make a decision in terms of which one to follow? Or there's a third thing you could do, and that is you could start with Christianity. Now you're thinking, of course you would say that. You're a Christian. Well, okay, I'm biased. I've been invited by the Christian Union to do this talk. But I want to give you three reasons before we finish as to why starting with Jesus is actually a really good place to start. Why would that be the best place to start? Let me explain. Firstly, because Jesus is unique in the way you can investigate him. See, how do you know whether a religion is true? It's a good question, but it's often difficult to answer because religions are often based on philosophy and morality, things that might work for you or not, things that you might like or not, but they're subjective rather than objective. There's no way you could actually say this is objectively true. Even if Buddha didn't exist, the system of Buddhism would still work. And how would I objectively, for instance, investigate the claim that Muhammad did go into a cave and receive the words of Allah as we have them now, the Quran? No one else was there. I can accept it or reject it, but there's no objective way that I can really investigate the basis of the truth of it. I want to suggest that with Jesus it's different. Because Christianity is based on Jesus Christ. The clue is in the name, isn't it? Someone once said, if you take Christ out of Christian, you're left with three letters, I-A-N, and Ian can't help you. That's a cheesy joke, so I shouldn't use it. But if Christianity is based on Jesus, not just his teaching, but his life, and in particular, his resurrection, the early Christians made it the foundation stone of the Christian faith, that is something you can investigate. It was a public event, and you can look into it. And we'd encourage you to do exactly that. There's an objective way in which you can investigate the truth claims of Christianity to find out whether it's real or not. Make sure you do it. Here's a second thing, though. Start with Jesus because he's unique in what he claims about himself. You see, Muhammad claimed to be a prophet, speaking on behalf of God. Buddha claimed to be enlightened. And yet Jesus Christ made a claim which was categorically different. The conviction of the early Christians from the outset was that in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, God himself had broken into human history as a human being. Now, what was it that made strict monotheistic Jews, who were probably even more unlikely than we are to come to that conviction and belief, come to that belief? Well, firstly, because of what Jesus said, his claims. Jesus made incredible claims, the claim to forgive sins, the claim to be one with God, the claim to represent God, the claim that if you had met him, you had met God. He took the name of God from the Old Testament, the I Am, and used it repeatedly to refer to himself. Incredibly egocentric claims, but not simply the claims of Jesus, but the actions of Jesus. that backed up his claims and showed his ability to make them in the first place. His authority over sickness, his authority over evil, over death itself, his own resurrection from the dead. And the conviction of these early Christians was that in the person of Jesus, God himself had broken into human history. That wasn't a later claim that evolved 100 or more years later. It was right there at the outset. In fact, if you like archaeology, a little bit of archaeological evidence that confirms this was found in Rome. And it's a cartoon, of all things, found inscribed on a wall in Rome that dates from probably about the 2nd century. And it's actually a cartoon from someone who was an opponent, an enemy of Christianity, mocking Christians for their belief in Jesus. It's got a man, Alexamenos, as the text will tell us, worshipping a crucified figure with a donkey's head. And underneath the text that says, Alexamenos worships his God. Now, although this was designed to mock the Christians for their belief in Jesus, it shows us something fascinating, that even from the outset, the enemies of Christianity understood that Christians believed in a crucified Messiah who they claimed to be God, that they worshipped. Actually, there's an interesting side to the story as well, and that is just off to the side of the cartoon, someone else had inscribed the words, Alexamenos is faithful. Maybe that was a Christian trying to get their own back, I don't know. But this belief in Jesus, in the inbreaking of God into human history, was right there from the outset. Why? And if that is true, that makes Jesus unique out of all religious leaders through history. Our search for the truth would find its fulfillment in him. And then thirdly, why start with Jesus? Because he's unique in what he offers. See, how would you define religion? Some of us are religious, but many of us are not. And I guess when we think of religion, we basically think of it as a system of what we do to make ourselves good enough so that we go to heaven, if that's where you want to go, or be reincarnated as something better, if that's what you believe. But it's all about what we do to get something from God, if there is a God to get something from. But the problem with that, for those, particularly those who are not religious, is, well, what does that lead to? It could lead to two things, couldn't it? If religion is about what we do, it could lead to pride. God accepts me because I'm better than you, because I have done it. Or it could lead to despair. There's no hope for me because I've not done enough. God could never accept me. But either way, whether I'm proud or depressed, I'm going to be a pain in the neck to everyone else, aren't I? So we can be suspicious of religion because of what it might lead to. But at the heart of Christianity is not the message of what we must do for God, but a message of what God has done for us. Jesus didn't simply come to teach us how to live. He lived the life we should have lived, but then he died the death we should have died. And he offers to us not a message of karma, that we should get what we deserve, but the offer of grace, that we can get what we don't deserve. That because Jesus took what we deserve, the ultimate consequences for our wrong on the cross, we can have what we don't deserve. A relationship with God restored, not on the basis of what we've done, but what he has done. It's grace, not karma, that makes the difference. Can I just think about the implications of that for a moment? If religion can lead to pride and despair, what would this message of grace lead to? Can I suggest quite the opposites? Firstly, it shouldn't lead to pride, because the first step to following Jesus Christ is not to think you're better than everyone else, but to realize that you're not. Which, by the way, is why it's so hard to become a Christian, not because there's something you must do, but precisely because there's nothing that we can do. We have to admit that we're not good enough. So it shouldn't lead to pride, but it shouldn't lead to despair, because even though we have to admit that we can't do enough, we know the one who has. So we can know complete acceptance with God on the basis of what Jesus has done, not what we have done. It should lead to joy, not despair, to humility, not pride. So if you think that following Jesus is going to make you into the most arrogant person alive, you need to look at what it means to follow Jesus. I've got a friend in Bournemouth, where I live. I've got more than one friend, but I've got one friend particularly that I hang out with very often. We go to watch football and we go for meals, and he's an atheist. And my friend says to me on occasions different issues that he has with Christianity. And on one occasion, my friend said to me, he said, Michael, he said, the problem with Christianity is this. Christians are so arrogant. They think they're better than everyone else. And so I said to him, I said, look, I'm a Christian. Do you think I'm like that? And he said, no. Now, he had to say that because I was buying his dinner. So then I said to him, well, your wife, she's a Christian. Do you think she's like that? And he thought for a moment and he said, well, no. And again, he had to say that because I would have told her. But then I said, look, there's a number of people you know in this town who are Christians. And I named a few of them. Do you think they're like that? He said, no. I said, can you name me a Christian that you think is arrogant? He said, no. And I said, so why have you rejected Christianity on the basis of this presupposition that isn't borne out by the reality of your experience? That's not been your experience of Christianity. Has it been yours? Maybe you don't know many Christians. Well, there are some Christians around here. You could check them out, not just the good-looking ones. Check them all out and ask the question, does this belief in Jesus and his grace make them into arrogant, morally superior people or not? Because it shouldn't if they've understood what Christianity is all about. And if, by the way, you think this is exclusive, this is something for white, Western, middle-class people, can I say that it's precisely not that way? Yes, the claims of Jesus are very exclusive, and yet in one sense they're also so inclusive, because they're for anyone. Which is why today the Christian church is growing most rapidly, not in Western Europe, but in places like Afghanistan and Iran and Algeria and Nepal and China. Because following Jesus is not about accepting British or Western culture, it is about coming to know a person who offers you life and forgiveness and transformation. And I wonder, my question to you is, have you come to discover that? Maybe you think this is rubbish. Well, you're right, you have the right to hold that opinion. But my challenge to you would be, do you come to that conclusion on the basis of your investigation into Jesus, or is that the assumption that you've gained because that's what everyone else thinks? Can I challenge you to investigate the claims of Jesus for yourself? Start with one of the accounts of his life and think about it for yourself. Maybe you realize, actually, you do need to think about this more. And I would then go on to tell you about the follow-up courses that are going to happen. But we won't need to do that today.